Welcome to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz with Maine Public's Steve Missler and Mal Leary. Well, he's back. Of course, you could argue former Republican Governor Paul LePage hasn't really gone that far since leaving office last January. He's done numerous talk radio interviews and commented on goings-on repeatedly. But now, Steve Missler, he's made a major public address. This was his first since leaving the Blaine House. Tell us about it.
So he held basically a forum at Colby College. He was invited by the college Republicans there. And, you know, he basically talked for about an hour and did sort of a question and answer session for about 40 minutes of that. It was interesting in a number of ways. Again, it just sort of reaffirms this idea that, you know, he is still itching, as he pretty much was before he even left office, to run again. He just seems to really have some difficulty, you know, just letting go of the idea of running. And to be fair, why not? He continues to be popular in the Maine Republican Party. Anytime he puts out something on, you know, Facebook or social media, you know, there's always a big response to it, often very encouraging from people who support him. But what was interesting about this event, too, is that if he does actually indeed harbor ambitions for 2022, if he's to challenge Democratic Governor Janet Mills, he did what I viewed as sort of a reframing of the 8 tumultuous years during his 2 terms as governor. And he did that in a really simple way, which was to basically blame the press for reporting on his words and deeds during those 8 years. He pretty much did that from the get-go. He did a brief introduction, talked about his Dickensian life story, which is, you know, quite captivating, and then proceeded to rail against the press for a good 10 or 15 minutes and even brandished a newspaper at one point and basically said, they're still not treating me fairly. They've never printed my life story.
Since 2010, they have not printed who I am.
He again used it later on during the question and answer session, because during this event, there were a lot of protesters, student protesters and otherwise, that were there to sort of remind him of some of the more controversial and divisive things that he has said. But anytime they attempted to engage him on those matters, he would just simply say, well, you read that in a newspaper, and they never get what I say correctly. And so he was using the press as a sword and a shield in many ways. That seems to be his tactic of dealing with this legacy that continues to follow him and will follow him into 2022.
I remember going to the State House and reading his innumerable veto messages, many of which were filled with language you never see from a governor. I mean, the political discourse has been very different since Janet Mills came to office in January. And I'm kind of curious, I guess, as you've talked to people who are Republicans, whether they either have welcomed this return to a softer rhetoric, or whether they feel that LePage's harder edge was actually more productive for them.
What I've found is that some Republicans certainly like that combative style. I mean, especially this year, where they were out of power. You know, they had lost so much, so many seats in the 2018 election, and they were virtually powerless. And so I think there was some desire to return to, you know, a time when they had more power and influence and were could be more combative because of it. And LePage certainly brings back that certain nostalgia. At the same time, there was a lot of rumbling when the former governor immediately started weighing in on proposals that Janet Mills would put forward and talking about how terrible they are. And then the press, because it's had accustomed to be, you know, to going to the former governor for 8 years, would quote the governor. And Republicans, rank and file, would come to me and say to me privately, why are you guys quoting LePage? When he's not here, we are. And I think that that speaks to an issue within the party writ large, which is that while there is certain nostalgia for Governor LePage, because he did represent a time of success for them, he has the effect of crowding out people who may one day want to succeed him or at least aspire to his political ambition. So it's a tricky balancing act, I think, within the party between longing for the time when he was in power and they were too, and also realizing that as long as he stays in the ballgame, he kind of takes the air out of the room for them.
Really, Erwin, what we're seeing here is a battle for the soul of the Republican Party. Mm. That's what it really comes down to. If you recall, there were battles between Republicans that were in control of the state Senate and with the governor. There was a period of time when Mike Thibodeau, the president of the Senate, hadn't spoken with the governor for months, And I think we're seeing a continuation of that, where LePage is trying to stay relevant on the possibility that he'll run. I'm not so sure that will happen, but he keeps making those noises. And the Republicans are trying to build a new group of lawmakers. We're seeing that in the 2nd District, trying to challenge Jared Golden, who knocked off Bruce Poliquin in that 2nd Congressional District seat. I think you're going to see it in other ways as we move forward in sort of the insidery stuff of the control of the Republican State Committee. It now has a lot of Trump people in control. That may change over the next year as they're putting together the effort to retake the legislature.
It's interesting. I won't name names, but I was recently in Washington, D.C., and I ran into some former Republicans at the airport there. And these are people who were very loyal to the governor while he was here, and found themselves on the wrong side of him because he effectively, if not explicitly, endorsed Sean Moody in the gubernatorial campaign. And if that happens, it can be a very lonely place, as Mal just pointed out, with Senate President Mike Thibodeau, who was one of the people that was running for governor and found that he couldn't do it because LePage had basically clobbered him for a better part of 2 years because they disagreed on tax policy. And so you can argue that, you know, the former governor has limited the size and depth of the Republican bench. And you saw that in the 2nd Congressional District, where the Republicans were trying to find candidates to challenge Jared Golden. And it was difficult for them because there was very few high-profile candidates coming out of the LePage administration, which is typically a place where you can build a bench through their cabinet. It's a double-edged sword for the party. On one hand, again, he remains a popular figure. On the other hand, he does have the effect of crowding out the voices of other people that may aspire to what he has already achieved.
And it's worth noting, of course, in that regard, too, that in that 2nd District race, he's actively going to work against his former press secretary, who is trying to run for the GOP nomination.
Yeah, he endorsed Dale Crafts, you know, who was a former lawmaker here. Dale Crafts announced that he had received that endorsement early on, but the governor took about a week to actually confirm it, which he did via tweet. And I think that that came as a bit of a surprise to Adrienne Bennett, who was his former press secretary, because she had been, if not expecting it, is at least hopeful that she would receive the governor's endorsement.
Of course, LePage has also been talking a lot about perhaps trying to run again for the Blaine House in 2022. Do we have a history of former governors attempting to remain active in elective office at the state level here?
Absolutely. You go back to the days when we elected governors every year, they often would rotate between, well, it's your turn this year, because the job was so short-lived. It was, you were in for one legislative session, then you were up for re-election. So it was a different world. More recent, we have the example of Governor Joe Brennan, who kind of traded places with then First District Congressman Jock McKernan, who ran for governor and got elected, and Brennan ran for the First District and got elected, and then 4 years later challenged McKernan for the governorship. So we've had this before. I would point out that that particular race got really nasty, and it was a very, very vitriolic race between the two. And I just suspect that if LePage came back and ran against Mills, would have a redo of that 1990 contest.
Right, and they have a history already, right?
Already have a history.
You know, because when she was attorney general,
I have a whole file that's just Mills versus LePage.
That's right. When she was attorney general and he was governor, I mean, they clashed repeatedly. You know, I mean, and at that time, it was interesting because I think Mills, in keeping with her sort of no drama credo, sometimes seemed reluctant to publicly engage the governor, but at the same time, there's no love lost there between those two. If that were to be the matchup in 2022, it would be really something.
Shall we say, Erwin, that the off-record comments I've heard from both of them about the other is not something we could broadcast?
All right, let's talk about, in the last week, of course, we've had additional revelations coming out of the Democrats' impeachment inquiry of President Trump. Has any of that had any impact on any of the main members of Congress, I guess, particularly Senator Collins, who has so far been silent on all of this?
Not really. I mean, you've had some comments. Shelley Pingree has been supportive of the inquiry all along. Well, you know, Jared Golden came in and said he supports an investigation. He was playing a little semantic game there, but that's fine. We did have Senator King a few weeks ago kind of break from the mold of, I'm not going to talk about it because I'm going to be a juror, to actually coming out saying it should be done, it should be an inquiry here. Collins has said that the process should go forward, but that she has to be careful what she says because she will be a juror as a member of the Senate. And she's pretty much been consistent with that. As to an impact on whether she's going to run or not, I think she's running. I mean, she just dropped a six-figure buy for her campaign committee on television and on cable and on the internet, just a day after Sarah Gideon, the principal Democrat that's got the most money that's running, started her campaigns. What's interesting is both campaigns are running these soft and squishy ads about, gee, look at all the great stuff I've done. I'm just an average person, et cetera, trying to build up some positives, because at the same time that they're running those positive ads, we have the great dark money groups coming in, blasting the others, you know, the groups that are attacking Collins, the groups that are attacking Gideon. They're spending just incredible amounts of money for an election that's more than a year away.
What I found interesting is that a lot of her colleagues in the Senate are beginning to adopt this position that she has taken from the beginning, which is that we may be potential jurors, so we don't really want to comment on revelations that are leaking out of what are so far closed door impeachment hearings or inquiries. If you pull back a little bit, I mean, Republicans, for the most part, have only been able to criticize the process. But when asked about the substance of testimony that's been leaked out, like, for example, Bill Taylor, who is the top U.S. diplomat to Ukraine, you know, really devastating testimony. And you couldn't find any Republicans, really, that wanted to address what he said, even though it came out in the form of a 17-page statement. It wasn't just hearsay passed along through Democratic committee members who were leaking information. It was a, you know, written testimony. But what you're finding is that Republicans are going to attack the process because right now it is behind closed doors. It will eventually come out into public view, but they seem to be taking this tack that Collins did right from the beginning, frankly. It's an interesting position to take because at the end of the day, this is a quasi-legal but mostly political process. So the idea that, you know, they need to be sequestered like a real jury, that's not really the case. And, you know, if you look at history and past impeachment inquiries, senators who were ostensibly jurors then also talked about it, you know.
And this is causing fits for the Trump White House, where they're trying to get both the House Republicans and Senate Republicans to do more to protect the president from this process. Well, what's happened in the Senate is very interesting. Lindsey Graham, his on-again, off-again friend, has come out with a resolution opposing the House impeachment. This will be a resolution passed by the Senate saying, House, you shouldn't do this. Well, Collins is one of, as of today, seven Republican senators who have not weighed in and supported that. And part of it's because what Steve was talking about, they're all saying, look, I may have to be a juror on this thing. So I'm not going to tell the House what to do. That's their job. Their job is impeachment. The question of guilt or innocence is up to the Senate. So that's giving them some real cover. And I think you're going to see Lindsey Graham have the problem of putting forth this resolution that fails, or deciding, well, maybe I won't bring this resolution forward because it's going to fail.
And on to the Senate race as we sort of await Collins' official announcement that she's running. I mean, she's doing everything, including, as just Mal just pointed out, running ads. What's interesting, too, about the ad buys that are taking place between her and Sarah Gideon, who, by all accounts, is, you know, the leading Democrat. the one with the most money anyway, you know, vying to take her on, is that people like Betsy Sweet, who is also in the primary, she doesn't have enough money to go up on television. And I actually had an interview with Yvette Simpson, who's the head of Democracy for America, which actually has endorsed Betsy Sweet. And Yvette Simpson basically flat out acknowledged, she's like, we're not going to be able to compete with either Susan Collins's money or Sarah Gideon's money. What we're going to have to do is do this through talking to people, meeting with grassroots activists. Betsy has held, I think, 17 so far and counting. They see that as their path, their only path, frankly, because of all the Democratic-aligned groups that came out and endorsed Gideon basically the day she announced or shortly thereafter. You know, that's the other effect here, is that you're seeing other Democratic hopefuls sort of withering, you know, unless they're able to do what Betsy Sweet is doing. I mean, and that's why we had John and Tracy drop out earlier this week, basically saying, look, I don't have the money to do this. And look how much money they've raised and are spending right now. You know, it's over a year away. That's the effect of all this money, frankly, and the fact that both Gideon and Collins are already up with ads.
All right, gentlemen, thank you very much for the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Owen.
Thank you.
Maine Public's State House Bureau Chief Steve Missler and senior political reporter Mal Leary. And that's Maine's Political Pulse for this week. We post new versions of our podcast each Friday afternoon. You can download it at mainepublic.org/politicalpulse or wherever you get your podcasts. You can hear most of the Political Pulse Sunday mornings during Weekend Edition and a shorter excerpt on Monday's Morning Edition. Willis Ryder Arnold is our producer. Music is by Rob Holt. I'm Erwin Gratz.